You're listening to the Script Lab Podcast. I'm Shani Edwards.
On this episode, I chat with Dan Ewan, writer of the family comedy Playing with Fire, starring John Cena, about a group of fire jumpers who rescue three kids, only to find out they're about as wild as any fire can be. Today, Dan talks about his long journey to getting this film made, which actors were originally attached to play the lead, and how much of his original script remains after a million rewrites. But before we get to Dan, I want to say thank you so much for listening to this podcast and for sharing with your friends and colleagues. I feel truly blessed to be part of this really special writing community. And if you ever have any questions for me, you can always hit me up on Twitter. I'm at Shani Edwards. Now let's hear a clip from Playing with Fire.
Put that down. No shenanigans on my watch.
Yeah, no monkey shines, tomfoolery, or hijinks.
You finished?
Long as there's not a hint of malarkey.
Whoa. Now, if I didn't know any better, I would say that that was sarcasm. So why don't we just take it down a notch, sister, okay? Maybe a little gratitude would be helpful.
Sorry, bud, we just don't speak oldsy times.
Oh my gosh, oh my God, but she's not stopping.
Hi, Dan.
Hi, Shani.
So great to talk to you about Playing with Fire. I'm just so thrilled for you. And in full disclosure, I've known you at least 20 years.
Yes, a long time.
Long time.
From the improv circuit.
Yes, we met doing improv comedy, sketch comedy, and your wife, beautiful Kim, was involved in that too. And now you have this major motion picture.
Major motion picture event. I just joked that no matter what happens this weekend, I'll have the number one firefighter-based family comedy in America.
That's a huge accomplishment.
Ooh, I mean, of all the family firefighter-based family comedies, I mean, this is going to go down as one of the top 10 for sure.
For sure.
Humbling.
Yeah.
Very humbling.
So let's go back a little bit, because I know you've been at this a while. So what was it that actually started to get your career to move forward to the point where you got noticed and could make this film?
It's interesting. I think if you can kind of imagine two curves going upward, and one curve is actually getting better at what you do, better at the craft itself, to use the lame Gladwell cliche, putting in 10,000 hours and really reading other screenplays, having your stuff torn apart, recognizing why it was torn apart, what you can do better, getting better at that. And there also is a networking aspect to it. And I think that's the second curve, getting in a position where you're meeting people and you have open doors. You know, 95% of your meetings will specifically not add to anything. But what you hope is when you leave that meeting, there's an open door where you can bounce ideas or bounce even a paragraph off of someone who you could then partner with. And this was developed and written a spec that went absolutely nowhere. But as I just learned, nothing is ever dead. But that process created a strong connection with a producer named Sean Robbins. And we stayed in touch. We had kind of an open dialogue about stuff and bounced an idea off him here and there. That's not right for us. That's not right for us. And I had that open door, and when I was sitting with my lovely wife, and she had heard a story about the safe haven law, which says you can, a safe place to abandon a child, hospital, police station, or fire station. And that was the first time I thought, oh, fireman and a baby, that's one of those sexy fireman calendars come to life. That's, woo, that's gangbusters right there. And that was how it first started. And that was basically a two sentence thing that I flung at this open door I had to Sean Robbins 14 years ago.
14 years.
14 years on this one. Oh my gosh, the stops and starts of this. So it went from that one email and a response, can you come in tomorrow? To that email, you know, that one liner became a one pager. That one pager became a treatment. That treatment became another treatment, another treatment, another treatment. And then 17 drafts of this over the course of a decade. And within that, this is some This is some insider info. We had a yes from Matthew McConaughey. This is the funniest part. We got a yes from McConaughey. And it speaks to the duality of Matthew McConaughey that this was a period after he had done Failure to Launch and some Ghosts of Girlfriends Past, some stuff that... I'm not taking anything away from those projects. They are what they are, and they serve a purpose and all that. And he and his producing partner loved playing with fire. Loved the idea of him being fireman, gets to do some action-y stuff. And then the rest of his team. So we had a yes from McConaughey for about 72 hours. And then his other rep said, wait. You do realize you're super good at acting? you're like pretty good at this, Matthew. What if we, like, let's try and position, let's try and, like, put you in some artsy stuff. And so if you follow the timeline, the stuff, I like to think I scared Matthew McConaughey into doing Dallas Buyers Club, Mud, Wolf of Wall Street. I think I scared him into this amazing renaissance where he had gone to some pretty dark places with his comedy choices, some would say. And then now, you know, he's driving Lincolns and selling beef. And who knows what he's capable of? He's still a young person. But that was the first nibble that went away. There was a Samuel Jackson interest. Great meeting. I mean, I did rewrites all along this path, kind of. And it's for a little free bit of chasing. Yes. I mean, I'm substitute teaching at this point.
Right.
You know, and so just as very realistic, I'm trying to, you know, I'm sitting there with Sam Jackson. Like, that's a great, you know, that's someone I've thought so highly of for so long. I'm sitting there. Okay, now I've got to make this character, you know, a very different person. It's very different. Matthew McConaughey and Samuel Jackson, very different essences, you know. And so then you're doing a draft for Sam Jackson, and then that didn't happen. And then it's, I know, Kevin James is interested. Well, what is Kevin James? I mean, this is just some business shit.
That's great.
You know, what does Kevin James mean at this point? Like, Kevin James had a moment. Was this at the end of his moment? This might not get it made. Okay, that went away, you know. And then, interestingly enough, director Andy Fickman, 6 years ago, really responded to the script. And he had made a movie called Parental Guidance that was this sleeper hit with Billy Crystal and Bette Midler that no one saw coming, that made a hundo out of nowhere in a very modest budget.
And it's your agent and managers that are getting the scripts out?
This was, no, that, well, this at this point, it was this relationship with Sean Robbins, and it became, Sean Robbins had gone on to work with Todd Garner.
Okay.
At Broken Road, and they were independent at this point. But it was very much just, Todd Garner has made a bunch of these tough guys with kids movies that were, I mean, he was at Revolution Studios. I think they did Are We There Yet? He did Daddy Daycare. I think Cheaper by the Dozen. He's done, this was a genre that had this was money in the bank in that era. And so it felt like this was the right producer if this was ever going to get done, because he is the 800 pound gorilla of that kind of movie. The interesting thing that happened was that kind of movie stopped being made. And from a studio perspective, okay, we're going to make a family movie. We could spend $100 and make an animated movie. And if an animated movie hits, you could make $700 million, $800 million. Or we can make a modest budget family comedy that could make $100 million. And so as far as putting chips on a roulette table, studios started to lean toward, well, let's make animated stuff. So this movie went, this genre really went the way of the dinosaur. And unfortunately, I had finished this this spec really kind of at the end of that. And so people were trying to wrap their heads around the medium budget family live action movie. So this was something that Todd Garner said, listen, I can tell you any meeting I take with people who make medium sized budget movies, I'm going to slide a piece of paper across the table and it's going to say on there all those titles and the box office they made.
Smart.
And So this thing was on a slab. This thing had no pulse at all. Kind of, we gave it a go. It was something I had written off as the thing that's going to be collecting dust on the shelf. And Paramount had a new division called Paramount Players, headed up by Brian Robbins, who's now running Nickelodeon. But they wanted to make medium-sized movies. And Todd's question was, how do you feel about the family space? And they said, we're not afraid of the family space. And then Todd's question was, how do you feel about firefighters and kids? They said, let's read it. And I was staffing on a Disney show, and I got a phone call that Paramount, a division of Paramount, was willing to option the script for used Camaro prices to see if they could piece it together.
I just want to mention that the show you were on was called
Walk the Prank, which was a very interesting half-scripted and half actual pranks done to real people show on Disney XD. And my friend Trevor Moore created it, and we had had a blind deal at Universal and had taken another show out, and timing wise, he said, would you want to come and staff? Which staffing was wonderful. You know, working in features, you get maybe a lump sum here and there, but for the most part, it was baffling to have a regular check showing up. It was, what are these envelopes? I got another envelope. This is crazy. So staffing and all the snacks in the break room, you know, it's raining LaCroix and cashews on us. Oh, staffing was stellar. But so I got this call, and suddenly it had a little bit of life. And so I optioned it, go with God. It was like a zombie to me at this point. You're talking about 12 years in.
And it's like a couple grand, something
like that. Yeah, it was, I mean, it's really funny how a giant behemoth will bust you over 2,500 difference in numbers, but it happens. I mean, that's the job of business affairs. I mean, that's where everything takes forever is when it gets to business affairs. But they have a job to do. There was a question at that point. So, Dan, if you fight to do a rewrite on it, might be a situation. Brian Robbins, the head of Paramount Players, has a rewrite guy he loves and swears by. This will move back really quickly if we just option it and run with it. We have a plan. We know who we want to get to read it right away and who the studio wants to get it to. They told me it was Cena. And so I just said, yeah, let me option it. At this point, it's something that inexplicably reemerged onto my radar. Whatever's going to move it to wherever it might have life, go ahead. And so I optioned it to them, and the first person did a rewrite. Oh, it's been rewritten so many times. That's a whole nother, we'll get to that.
Yeah.
And then Cena liked it. And what's interesting, then apparently Paramount said, well, here's a list of directors that we would do this with. And as luck would have it, Andy Fickman was on that list, who I'd already done a draft. You know, we had Thai food 6 years ago and I did a draft for him based on his notes. You know, it was a lot of chasing. But again, you're a substitute teacher. You're recruiting focus groups. I was a Manny for 3 years. Like you see a path that could happen, you know, but as luck would have it, this Andy Fickman was on that list. So suddenly it was doubling back to Andy saying, Andy, remember playing with fire? Oh yeah, I remember that.
Boom.
Boom. John Cena, let's do this.
Amazing.
And so this bizarre combination of planets that have to align for something to roll camera, let alone for something to actually be on a screen, a conventional movie screen, happened with something that in my mind had become, well, that was a nice writing exercise, but they don't make those movies anymore, you know? And we'll see this weekend if they were justified in not making these movies anymore. But again, you're putting fewer chips on the table. I feel like I'm talking a lot about the business of it all, but that, you know, it is a business. It's this bizarre merger of art and commerce that doesn't exist in another Los Angeles is a bizarre place. Where does that, it used to be, in the town of blah, blah, that's where they make the great pottery and that, like, this economy is so largely based on performing arts. That's a bizarre thing. Sorry, a little bit of a tangent, but.
I think this is all fascinating information because all of us, I think, have had a script that was going to go and then it didn't. And that was 10, 15 years ago. You know, I can relate to that myself.
Yeah.
So why didn't they ask you to rewrite it?
So I feel like execs become, it's personalities. And if an exec has a really great relationship with a writer and feels that that writer could sprinkle a certain amount of pixie dust on it, they don't know me from a hole in the wall. I'd never met at Paramount Players. I never met Brian Robbins. And it was kind of look, I've got a guy who I think could do whatever we want done to it. And I want to bring him in. Can you get this pile of papers for me, Todd and Sean? Can you get this signed off on so I can do what I need to do to make this movie? And I don't know how. I didn't have the inside baseball. How in love with it are they? If I fight to do a rewrite on, if I fight to be the first rewrite person, are they going to have someone else rewrite it afterwards? Am I stalling the whole process? You know, and I also thought I wrote a really good script, to be honest. I know that's exactly why they don't have writers around. Because, but what about on page 58? I mean, the motivation for Jake Carson when he's changing the baby's diaper is to, you know. And so I understand why writers kind of get a bad rap. Because sometimes you might feel precious about certain scenes. But there are also things you're thinking about that rewrite person X isn't thinking about. Or rewrite team X. And as it turns out, it was rewritten by the first rewrite person. By the way, Matt Lieberman, great person, great guy, contacted me immediately because we have mutuals and said, Dan, I'm Matt Lieberman. We have some mutuals. I'm rewriting Playing with Fire. I wanted to say that I thought you did a really great job with that script, which is a really cool thing.
Nice guy.
Because rewriting happens on so many things that actually are going to roll camera because everyone gets nervous and I understand it. So you're Paramount. Your Paramount Players, you're placing a big bet on a genre that hasn't been around for a while. You're placing a bet in the, you know, dozens of millions, and you start to get worried. And we gotta have as many jokes in there as possible. We gotta make sure. And so you end up rewriting and rewriting and rewriting. So there was the first rewrite person, Matt, who we share credit, because what he changed was a lot, because it was a Christmas movie. 17 drafts, it was a Christmas movie.
Oh.
So the kind of 17 drafts was a Christmas movie that what's the raised stakes of these macho Marines of firefighting suddenly having to take care of these kids is to actually having to put on a Christmas for these kids because the authorities can't get up to the mountains in time and da da da. And kind of, now they're really on, you know, skating on ice, trying to pull this off, blah, blah, blah. But that's when the marketing department comes in and says, we don't want to fight with other Christmas movies. Okay? Because for every Christmas movie that blows up, there's one that kind of gets lost in the shuffle. They say they don't want to fight with Christmas movies. So they take out Christmas. The big rewrite change was taking out Christmas because the entire second half of this movie, of the many, many drafts of this movie, were Christmas, Christmas, Christmas.
And that's what Matt did, not you.
Yes. And so that was a big change. And it still exists in kind of a form. One of the kids has a birthday. So some of the stuff of them having to throw some event is still in there. But that was major. And it's because they didn't want to have it come out near the holidays. And it was going to be a March release. Then Sonic the Hedgehog's mouth looks weird. So they move Sonic because they got to fix Sonic because of public outcry about Sonic's teeth. I don't know if you read about that.
You know what? It does ring a bell. I'm not that familiar with the franchise, but what was the issue with his teeth?
Just looked really creepy and became all people were talking about at the first Sonic teaser was what is up? That is the creepiest looking thing. So Sonic suddenly gets moved. So this movie that was a Christmas movie through almost the entirety of its development is no longer a Christmas movie, but then gets moved to November. Right? And so, and there are promos now that have Christmas music playing and are all red and green, and that they want it to feel like a holiday movie. And I totally, and it's a different head of marketing now, who happens to be a basketball buddy of mine. We play every Tuesday. And he said to me, this is on the red carpet in New York last week. He said to me, "Damn, why isn't this a Christmas movie?" And my head exploded. It was a Christmas movie for 17 drafts. It was a Christmas movie. Of course it's a Christmas movie.
Of course.
Yeah, so now it's not a Christmas movie, but it's coming out at a really good Christmas movie time. And it's coming out opposite a Christmas movie, against a Christmas movie, that last Christmas.
I saw that last night.
Yeah. Oh, did you? Yeah. So it's coming out against another, like the rom-coms are trying to find. Rom-coms are going to have rebirth, and everyone's been talking about rom-coms having a resurgence. And so they're going for a same kind of thing in a way that a live action slapstick family comedy is going for. Is wait, people loved these. People loved these movies.
Like, they did.
Why not? Like, people will love those movies again. Yeah, so rewritten, then rewritten by another team as a comedy pass, then rewritten by another team as a comedy pass, then an entire comedy roundtable of comedy writers throwing in jokes.
And you weren't there for any of it.
None of it. You know, they acquired the pile of papers. They acquired it, and then they ran with it. And so they're bringing in people who they believe are making it better. Now, this is an interesting thing we talked about. They're making a big bet. People's jobs are on the line. They're vouching. They're saying this is going to be a 40 whatever million dollar bet. And so they start. They feel that more is better. It's really the one area I can think of in film where too many cooks becomes the immediate, especially in comedy. Too many cooks becomes the immediate drill. We need to bring in the funniest people, just shove in more. Because the script is becoming less funny to them every time they read it. Because when's the last time you laughed at a joke the second, third, fourth time you heard it? So I feel like there's a vicious cycle in comedy especially, because a joke is funny when you first read it. So, oh, we really need to punch up scene 5. Well, scene 5 was, it takes a special kind of conviction in comedy to know, no, that's funny. And the 8th time we've read it, it's not as funny because it's the 8th time we've read it. But we got to stand by scene 5. And that's a conviction that when you get nervous and you start thinking, no, we need more gags. And then you're bringing in people with who may be the funniest people in the world. I've seen the list of the Comedy Roundtable. Mm-hmm. I saw the people that attended it. And they're very funny people, a lot from the Twitter sphere that I know. Like people who came in, people who know how to put funny into things. But there are also the 700 variables that they're not thinking of that the original writer was thinking of.
Sure.
Character-wise, what's the bit on page 8 that you slyly call back on, improv-wise, that you call back on page 51 that's going to be a big laugh? And it's gone now because someone in a comedy roundtable threw their hand up and threw out a funny quip that gets thrown in there. So it's a very interesting to you sign away that pile of papers and the shooting script looks, all the framework is very, 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 very similar. I don't know that there's a line left.
Wow.
And it's a movie coming out on a big, it's a wide release. I am thankful to the film gods. Again, the planets that have to align for something to end up. And not even, and this is a knock on streaming, but this is coming out on 3,000 plus screens. This is the way movies used to come out. Boy, howdy, you know?
Well, the good news is that it's very funny. And the performances are really hilarious. I mean, you got some of the best comedic actors around.
Well, this is the funniest part. So on top of the shooting script looking so different, I'm not even saying different or worse, but just by the nature of the beast, 30 writers had a hand in it by then. Or I wouldn't say 30, but say if it's 10 at the round table, you know, 17 other writers had a hand. Then they go on set with Leguizamo, Keegan-Michael Key. These are improvising. These are comedy, brilliant comedy entities that are on a set. And I say, number one thing about Andy Fickman, his sets are a party. His sets are fun. He lets them play. And at the premiere, Ficky told me, I have a half hour of Keegan footage.
Wow.
Usable. Riffing.
Doing all.
There's a scene where, yeah, just, and there's a scene where he's straightening a picture, straightening a photo that's up in memoriam in the smoke jumper base. And in the movie, it's a really funny 30 seconds.
Yes.
And he said, it rolled for 7 minutes.
I'm not surprised.
Straightening a crooked picture.
Yeah.
It was 7 minutes where we just rolled and he just went and went and went. I mean, Keegan-Michael Key he's so brilliant.
Yes.
I'm immediately trying to put him in other things of mine because I think he's the truth. He's the truth. He's so truth. Good in this.
He is so good.
So even then, even more, just, you know, it's a reminder that by the time something gets actually to screen, 40 people have had a say in it changing in some way or another, at least.
For a big studio movie.
For a big studio movie. I don't want to sound sour grapes about it because it's a very rare to have a movie get made, but it's also very strange to, here's what I have worked on for, at that point, for 12 years and what I've developed with the producers. But then second, once it's purchased and then they want to do X, Y, and Z to it, suddenly, well, we can't do a Christmas movie because the marketing department decides the entire second half can't be about that. And then, well, we want to change this and then so you realize, and these are all different people doing the work, and it becomes a little bit of a Franken-script in a way because you're, interestingly enough, that so when I first started, this is how long ago it was, when I first started it, Todd gave me the working draft of Chuck and Larry. I now pronounce you Chuck and Larry, the Sandler movie, because we didn't want to step on any firehouse jokes that they're doing. That script, so it hadn't been arbitrated by the WGA yet to decide, the credit arbitration hadn't been done to decide who gets actual credit on it. So it had every name of everyone that had done a pass.
Wow.
It had 16 names on Chuck and Larry.
Goodness gracious.
Everyone from Sandler himself to Alexander Payne to Gary Ross.
Wow.
To Robert Smigel it was an impressive list of names. And it ended up, I don't know how many people got actual credit on it, 3, 4, but the idea of, holy shit, the studio said, holy shit, we're making an Adam Sandler movie. Throw everything at it. And then when you watch the movie, and I watched it and I enjoyed it, it made 125 or something. It was one of Sandler was money, 100 million, anytime, 100 million every time, everything he ever did. Except for Punch Drunk Love, which is his best work. So you'll watch that movie and there'll be a heartbreaking scene where a guy is pouring his heart out about his wife passing away. And you can tell, oh, that's the Alexander Payne. Oh, they brought Alexander Payne and they said, rips, you know, let's get to the heart of this. And then the next scene is the guy cartwheeling during a fire, cartwheeling with a morbidly obese woman down the stairs who proceeds to fart in his face. And that is the greatest Franken-script tonally example I can think of.
Yeah, I was just going to say, tonally, that's a mess.
It's a big, you know.
Yeah.
But they, when you think, okay, well, what are the, and they have these things down to a science. They've got the dials and saying, well.
Right.
Oh, well, look how the female dial went up during that wife scene. Like, that's why we did that. That's why we did that, because they're going to hold to, oh, he loved her so much. And then, well, this is, who's going to be laughing? Who wants to see that Sandler classic physical stuff, you know, and that kind of, well, that's got to be in there too. And so you can see how a project begins serving many masters,
right?
And trying to hit every quadrant.
Yeah.
I'm sure they've identified more quadrants now.
Beyond four.
Are octrants a thing? I don't know. But so that was that. It's interesting when you see something that clearly had
too many cooks in the kitchen, to use your metaphor.
You know, I'm sure there are examples of comedies that, oh my gosh, this made me laugh every 18 seconds, and everyone threw in great stuff and all that. And then there's some where the confident person in me feels that, yeah, I could have done what they wanted to have done to it.
Sure.
But there is a sense of everyone has their rewrite people. Yeah. I love that Matt Lieberman looked me up and found me and said, I really like the job you did, because it felt good to hear that and to know, yeah, this part of the animal now is going to be crazy rewrites, feeling as they're trying to better it.
Right.
Does it?
It's a great question. Let's talk about, so what are you working on now? Like, did this help you? Are you employed? What's going on?
It's interesting. So right now, I just sold a series.
Congratulations.
Thank you. With Norman Lear.
Oh my goodness. Wow.
And Laverne Cox.
Oh, that's great.
And I can't say too much more about it till the people who, the it's a streamer.
Okay.
And they are figuring out with Sony. Norman Lear has a first deal at Sony. So Sony's involved. And so Sony and said buyer are figuring out their cut of everything. And then we're going to figure out if we're shooting the pilot or if we're doing a season or if we're doing what. But that has been it couldn't be more different than playing with fire. And then I developed a historical epic with Appian Way.
Wow.
that I just finished the spec, and we're now making a director's list. And so it's going to be pretty funny, because there will be, film gods willing, my follow-ups to this are going to be, my plan is to be unboxable, because the first thing they want to do is put me at work on everything within that specific genre. But I believe if you can find, like, I put a lot of heart in my Playing with Fire drafts.
Of course.
And the same questions of character and motivation, the same things you're looking at in The Lighthouse, or the same things you're considering when you're making a Criterion Collection movie, you're thinking about when you're making a popcorn family comedy.
Yeah.
You know, these are actually, yes, but when they're, this character who's going to be falling and bumbling throughout the whole movie also hasn't really dealt with the depth of his own father, and doesn't, and feels like getting close to people, that's all going to go away. People get close to all go away. And so he's kept people at bay. And you are thinking about all those things. Now, whether those things remain 90 drafts in, and, you know, by the time it's on screen, that's not always the case, but you are thinking of the same thing. So if you're thinking of, I believe, Appian thing, they're the first draft was funnier than they thought it would be. It's a historical effort, epic, and it's pretty dire. I can't blab about it.
That's okay.
But they loved that, because they feel that levity, I mean, it involves a giant disaster, a huge engineering disaster, and lots of deaths, and a very serious historical figure. But they love that there's levity in it, because they feel that you win people on board with a little bit of levity. It's not a laugh riot, but there is just enough to hang on to, where it's not drudgery. You've seen movies that you watch and they're great and they're drudgery, and you're cool with, I don't want to see that again. It's torture porn.
Yeah.
And so, at any rate, my goal is to become somewhat unboxable. And I still have comedy things that I'm pushing forward, sure, that are pretty straight up comedy, but I'm really excited on the Norman Lear thing.
Sounds great.
With Laverne, and working with Laverne, created it with Laverne Cox, and she's brilliant.
So usually I ask writers for advice. What advice do you have? And I wonder if there's something from your own path that you looked at, you could look back on and think, God, I wish I had done this differently.
Okay, never say no to work. The very first thing, I was such a little shit. The very first thing, I was an assistant on a show called Silk Stockings, USA Network. Stephen J. Cannell, you know, types on the typewriter, pulls the page out. Legendary television producer. And I was assistant, writer assistant, got my first slot writing an episode of Silk Stockings. I made it a tribute. It was called A Clockwork Florida Orange, and it was a Kubrick tribute. It's just about if you could do a Kubrick tribute with a Silk Stockings episode. But hey, it was the last season, so they said, "What the hell? Let's give him a slot." And so I wrote that, and I had this very gruff voice boutique agent say, "I'd love to represent you, and I'll send you out on Star Trek Next Generation, send you out to write a this, or, send you out to pitch on this and that." And at the time, I thought, "No, I came out here because of movies, and that's what I'm gonna do." And and consequently was unemployed for the next 3 years of my life, in the industry, And it was, if I could go back, I'd say, "You numbskull, what are you talking about? Mm-hmm. You found a crack in this giant wall." It's very difficult. Like, hit that again and again and again. And to work on your feature stuff too. But that, at the time, there was, now such amazing stuff is being done in series form. There was a kind of a, there were a lot more of, "Oh, they're a film." It felt divided, though, the TV people and the film people. And that's changed so much now, which is fantastic. And a lot of the best artistic stuff is actually being done in series form, which is great. So I'd say never say no to work. Also, you never know where that piece of inspiration is going to come from to turn into something big. I was working as a manny, as they like to say. And my job that day was to have the kids write their letters to Santa. Okay. And I'm looking down at the letter to Santa, with little glitter and all that on it. And the S was backwards. The kid, Ollie, had made a backwards S. And I was looking down at the card, and that's where it occurred to me how close the words Santa and Satan were.
Right.
And so after work, I went to a coffee shop. And I just started beating out just the rough. I always beat out on one page, just line by line, the scenes. Because if it works on a napkin, it works in a feature. The story is there. And I mapped out Dear Satan, which became my first feature sale to 20th Century Fox. And that was from working as a manny. And so you may feel like you're not doing something relevant to where you're headed, but that's not necessarily the case. Because that was the first idea that occurred to me, just because you got to pay bills. So stay open, stay open. Even when you feel stagnant, stay open, because that inkling is sitting there, mm-hmm. that will create a momentum for you.
Dan, that's really good advice. Thank you so much. I wish you nothing but the best of luck with Playing with Fire. It's hilarious.
Thank you.
And your streaming series coming up with Laverne Cox. I can't wait to hear all the details about it.
Thank you. As soon as I can blab about it, I shall.
Great.
But we're floating on air right now, and we're just raring to go.
Thanks.
Thank you.